section on technical analysis, you will learn 1. Rules to identify a trend. 2. How to read the story the trends are telling. 3. That investors use patterns to determine what is most likely to happen next. 4. How the use of technical tools helps investors find opportunities and see warnings. Allow discovery to happen. The first two chapters of this book introduce you to the idea of context. Those discussions were designed to help you open your mind so you can begin to think differently. Now you can feel that we are beginning to move into content and some of the important how-tos of investing. At this point, I want you to give yourself permission to learn fundamental analysis and technical analysis in a different way. If you do this, your experience will be more fun and enlightening right from the beginning. Here are a few suggestions to keep in mind as you dig into the chapters on fundamental and technical analysis. Move at your own speed. Unlike school, there's no test at the end of the week. There's no grade, so there's no pressure for you to learn everything completely and perfectly the first time you see it. I remember in college, I had to take an organic chemistry class. The material was very complex, but what compounded the problem was that I had to learn it so quickly. I felt pressure because I had to understand everything that was being presented the first time. The stress was brutal and not conducive to really learning the subject. I started to panic because the penalties for not understanding things were so severe and so immediate. I could become ineligible to play ball if I failed the test. It was hard to think of anything but that consequence. Even after college, I found myself reacting the same way out of habit. If I was in a situation where I didn't understand a concept quickly when it was given to me, I became tense, nervous, and stressed out. Now I have learned to relax and let things come to me at my own pace, but it took changing my context. By taking the pressure off, learning has now become one of my favorite activities. So, when you study the chapters on fundamental and technical analysis, please allow yourself, remind yourself to relax. I'm confident you will do just fine. If you ever do feel anxiety, let that be a signal to take a breath and relax. Remind yourself that it's okay to read the material more than once. It's okay to slow down. I still remember the lesson I learned from a teacher when she used the analogy of learning to drive a car with a manual transmission. We can surely move from ignorance to awareness to competency on the education continuum simply by listening to someone else explain the process of letting out the clutch and pushing the accelerator pedal. But proficiency comes when we're actually trying to follow the instructions by sitting in the driver's seat and trying to operate the car. When we try to put those concepts into action, we will inevitably stall the car. But it's not that big of a deal because stalling the car is part of the process. That's how you learn to drive a car with a manual transmission. We learn by making mistakes. After several attempts, you begin to get the feel of it. You learn how to make tiny adjustments until you get the point to where you can shift from gear to gear, listen to the engine, and know when to upshift or downshift, and even gently balance the clutch and brake when starting on a hill. Before long, you're driving that car without even thinking about it. You have arrived at proficiency. And just because you stall the car, it doesn't mean you're not learning. I stalled the car when my dad was teaching me. Will I teach my sons the exact same way? You bet I will. It's still the best way to teach. Killing the engine is just part of the process. No harm will come to my sons. I'll be sitting right there next to them until they get the hang of it. So please remember, there's no need to put pressure on yourself as you learn these investing concepts. Take a breath and enjoy the discovery. Once you've built your investing foundation with these first two pillars, it will become time to move on to the third pillar, which is certainly the most exciting one to an investor, cash flow. Pillar 3, cash flow strategies. Once we see the strength of a company, fundamentals, and the trend of the market, technicals, we then decide how we want to position ourselves to profit. Some investors put themselves in the position of aiming to profit from a capital gain, which means buying low and selling high, like when you buy and sell a house. Others aim to place themselves in a position of cash flow, like renting a house. To understand one strategy, it helps to understand the other. The term cash flow certainly gets everyone's heart beating a little faster. Ultimately, that's what we really want as investors. Because as money freely flows into your account through smart investment decisions, you'll experience what true freedom feels like. The goal of this book is to help you to begin to feel confident and comfortable in your ability to draw cash flow from the stock market on a regular basis, no matter the direction in which the market moves. That's the beauty of it. You'll learn how this can be done in markets that go up, down, or sideways. Cash flow is a solution to the problem of expenses. Everyone has expenses like food, clothing, shelter, taxes, and recreation, among many others. Expenses are the basic financial problem of life. We can solve that problem in one of four ways, referring to the cash flow quadrant: employee, self-employed, business owner, investor. If you need $5,000 to solve your expense problem, then to move from the left side of the quadrant to the right side, your financial statement must change from this, having income from a job, to this, having income from assets. The best cash flow is not dependent on bull markets. Many people who work at a job put money away into some sort of a contribution retirement program, such as a 401k or an individual retirement account, IRA. The money put into these accounts finds its way into the stock market through mutual funds or unit trusts, depending on the country in which you live. Whether or not you make money is often directly dependent upon the performance of the overall stock market. Due to the fact that these strategies are almost entirely focused on the long term, they are not a source of current cash flow for the investor. But here's the problem. The stock market doesn't always or only move in a steady upward direction. It can, and definitely does, travel upward or downward or remain stagnant for long periods of time. In the United States, the predominant account for retirement investments is called a 401k. Unfortunately, the value of these investments is dependent on a bull market. So rather than being designed to grow cash flow, they are designed to grow net worth. As the market fluctuates, so does the net worth. When I think about 401k accounts, they remind me of Aesop's fable about the goose that laid the golden eggs. Most contribution retirement plans rely on money earned in the past, what I call old money, to solve the expense problems in the future. The golden goose produces new money, but the golden egg relies on old money. The plans that rely on old money are in a risky situation. Instead of having monthly cash flow that could last indefinitely, the investor is left with what feels like two hourglasses. One is filled with money and the other with time. That's why one of the main fears people have is running out of money in retirement. This wouldn't happen if they knew how to generate new money. I want to introduce you to a totally new way of thinking, one you may have never considered before. These new golden goose ideas are different from what you experience when you let your money sit in long-term retirement accounts. When it comes to purchasing stocks, fundamental analysis is the process of gathering information about the strength of a company, and technical analysis is the process of gathering information about the supply and demand for that stock. When you have that information, you can use it to determine whether you're investing your money in a golden goose or a golden egg. You're going to discover that there are a variety of ways to harvest what you see in fundamental and technical analysis. In the chapters on cash flow strategies, you're going to see some examples of how to turn this information into potential profit, as well as some of the rules that we follow when we execute a certain investing strategy. I'm also going to give you some insight into how to choose one strategy over another, and some methods to give you confidence in the decisions you make to help you move toward your money and lifestyle goals. Learning many different cash flow strategies is like having many different colors available to you when you paint a picture. With a variety of colors in front of you, think of how much more effectively you can mix and match those colors to help that painting match your vision of what you want it to be. To their detriment, many investors develop fundamental and technical criteria that limit them only to capital gains. Moreover, many limit their toolbox to bullish strategies only. As a college athlete, I had to learn many different offensive schemes and had many plays in my playbook that could address many different situations. I would take what the defense gave me and find ways to win no matter what. The same can be said of taking what the market gives you, be it a trend up, down, or sideways, and addressing it. By learning different ways to position yourself for cash flow, or even a capital gain for that matter, you are beginning to understand that there are opportunities for profit no matter what the market does. Some of what you will learn in the section on cash flow. 1. How to get a capital gain when the market goes up. 2. How to get a capital gain when the market goes down. 3. How to get leverage without using debt. 4. How the stock and options markets can work together to generate cash flow. Pillar 4. Risk management. Whether you invest in real estate, stocks, or any other asset class, you have to remember, things can change suddenly. If the market crashes and your retirement is lost, do you have a plan B? If you save money and the dollar crashes, what will you do? If there's a flood and your home is lost, do you have insurance? No matter what you do, there are always some things that are beyond your control and others you can always control. Risk management is using the things you can control to deal with those you can't. I can't control the flood, but I can control whether or not I buy insurance. The relationship between risk and control. You might want to pause for a moment and consider this key point. Risk is related to control. Whenever someone is about to invest money or use debt as an investment lever, they would be wise to consider how much control they have over the outcome of the investment. The question of control is equally important for people who have placed large amounts of money into traditional retirement plans that are broadly diversified across markets. How much control do they have over the outcome? It is a sobering question to consider. An investor has no control over the first two pillars we discussed, fundamental analysis and technical analysis. When we look at a company's numbers, we understand that its performance is beyond our control. We don't make the day-to-day decisions inside the company. We are not out there selling its products. We may own some shares of the company, but we have little to no impact on company policy. Likewise, when we look at a chart of that company's stock, and we see the trend of the share price of the stock, we realize the direction of the stock price is beyond our control as well. No matter how badly you might want the price of a stock to go up, it's completely out of your control. The same is true with the company's earnings. We can't control these things any more than we can control the weather or the lottery. Remember that the first two pillars, fundamental analysis and technical analysis, are about gathering and analyzing information, not about controlling information. Things you can control. After you've gleaned some vital information by conducting a fundamental analysis, looking at the financial strength of a company, and technical analysis, looking at the supply and demand for the stock, it's time to consider a cash flow strategy and how you want to manage the risk associated with that strategy. Again, you have no control over the first two pillars, but you have total control and full responsibility for your action with the last two pillars. In other words, you really can't control what the weather's going to be, but you do get to choose how you'll deal with it. You can't control a hurricane that's coming your way, but if you gather information that shows a hurricane is coming, you can benefit from that information and begin selling emergency supplies to those who need them. You can also manage your risk by purchasing insurance to protect your own home. These actions are entirely up to you. The same is true with your cash flow investing. You also control the level of your financial education. In Chapter 1, we discussed the importance of investors becoming serious students. It's entirely up to you how far you want to go with each of the four pillars of investing. That's very good news. Because if we realize that our lifestyle goals are related to our money goals, and that our money goals are achieved when we reach our education goals, then the four pillars of investing become a clear pathway to success. We now know what to study and what to work on. We know how to grow our very own orange trees with endless supplies of delicious fruit. Some of what you'll learn in the section on risk. 1. You will learn about many different kinds of risks investors face. 2. You'll expand your financial vocabulary. 3. You'll learn about exit strategies. 4. You will learn about hedges. 5. You will learn about position sizing. The four pillars in the education continuum. Paper assets are a great place to start learning the four pillars because of its advantage in scalability and liquidity. But it would be a grave mistake, for example, to think that real estate investors do not need to understand technical analysis in their day-to-day business. I have heard Rich Dad advisor Ken McElroy declare many times that his real estate business is a trend business. The four pillars offer a foundation for any financial education. Now that you have a basic understanding of each of the four pillars, it's time to become more aware of what they are. It's time to begin to become more competent in each pillar. As you desire to become more competent, your mind will automatically search for mentors and ways you can practice to become more and more proficient because of the law of attraction, because this is simply how your brain works naturally. Focusing on your education goals more clearly identifies the people and the opportunities that will help you achieve your goals. This increased focus and desire to identify solutions will give you the feeling that these people and opportunities are being drawn to you. As you study the four pillars of investing, I encourage you to think about your progress in each pillar along the education continuum. It's a good way to evaluate where you are in your learning. There's a big difference between being aware of what a financial statement is and being proficient in conducting a fundamental analysis of that statement. There's a big difference between being aware of technical analysis and being proficient in reading stock charts. The process of moving towards proficiency in the education continuum is even more important with the last two pillars, cash flow and risk management, because this is where your decisions and actions will directly impact your profits. Cash flow strategies and risk management are double-edged swords. You can do the most good for yourself, but also the most harm. As investors, our goal is proficiency with these pillars. As you take this journey, enjoy the discovery of each pillar and remember that success is the natural order of things. Just let it happen. Chapter summary. Let's review some of the important points of Chapter 3. 1. Fundamental analysis helps us know the financial strength of an entity. A financial statement reveals the financial fitness of an entity. You can better use those numbers to see its value, diagnose its problems, and better forecast the future. 2. Technical analysis helps us identify trends. By reading stock charts, we can identify trends. We can see changes in supply and demand. We can see patterns that tell us what is likely to happen next. We can see warning signals in the market. 3. Cash flow strategies are how we choose to position ourselves to profit. Learning all the cash flow and capital gain strategies gives you the opportunity to take what the market gives you and have profit potential in any market, be it up, down, or sideways, instead of being at its mercy. 4. Risk management is about dealing with the unexpected. Every serious investor needs countermeasures to deal with the unexpected or to protect themselves when they're wrong. 5. The four pillars are not just for stock investors. They are for all investors. No matter the asset class, proficiency in the four pillars makes for better decision making.
Darren Weeks, Rich Dad Advisor on Raising Capital. Personal background and entrepreneur profile. Name, Darren Weeks. Date of birth, June 14, 1968. Place of birth, Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Traditional education, University of Alberta. Degree, Bachelor of Commerce. Started CPA program, but dropped out. Professional education, None. Grade point averages. High school, 2.45. College, 2.2. Value of traditional education relative to becoming an entrepreneur. In my opinion, it was not useful at all. I used very few of the lessons taught at university. If I had to do it all again, I would not have attended university. Subject I liked most in school. Social studies and current events. Subject I hated most in school. Math. Once they introduced the alphabet, all the X's and Y's, into math class, I failed continuously. Prior to that, I was one of the best math students in my class. First entrepreneurial project. When I was a young boy, I would shovel snowy sidewalks for neighbors, cut their grass, and deliver newspapers. The key entrepreneurial skill I was not taught in school. Biggest missing link is how to sell. Why and when I became an entrepreneur and my first major venture. I always wanted to be rich, so I would do whatever I thought could forward my objective. I invested in mutual funds in grade 6, and I also had my first business card for selling guppies in that same grade. First major venture was selling Inuit art in Canada. I quit my full-time government job to do so and continued to buy more real estate. Everyone thought I was crazy. To me, this experience was much more valuable than my Bachelor of Commerce degree. Best lesson from first business. Wow, so many. The realization that I wasn't going to receive a paycheck every 2 weeks and that I needed to have more discipline. I realized I needed to spend time looking for customers instead of avoiding that task. I was scared to sell and didn't know how to go about learning this important skill. I also had no idea how to build a team or use leverage to my advantage. I didn't use anyone else's time, skills, or money. I was the typical S with no leverage. What I learned about myself from my Kolbe Index. Please see companion file number 21. I am a typical entrepreneur and can spot opportunities easily, but do not like to follow through with the necessary details. My role in the BI triangle. My roles relate to communication and mission. For 16 years, I have been communicating the mission of Rich Dad to thousands of people around the world and am living proof that the strategies Robert and Rich Dad have taught work. Skills that are essential for entrepreneurs but not taught in schools. Communication skills and primarily sales skills. How to spot opportunities, which are literally everywhere. How to build a team. My most important lesson for entrepreneurs. I've learned that money is plentiful for investors who have a plan and a team. Money, or the lack of it, should never hold you back. I've also learned that while banks are very profitable businesses, relying on them can hurt your chances of entrepreneurial success. How I learned to raise capital. I had an attitude that I would not fail. So after a bank turned me down for a loan, I thought of then asking my friends, family, and associates if they wanted to team up with me for my project. And it worked for all of us. How I learned to overcome fear and failure. When I was 6 years old, I was a determined kid. I knew I would be rich, so I didn't have a lot holding me back. Also, after my first full-time Inuit art business, I realized that my effort level needed to increase if I wanted to achieve my financial goals. My personal strength. Perseverance and mindset. When I set my mind to something, I am damned and determined to succeed. My personal weakness. Laziness. Not working to my full potential, especially as I search for my next real mission on earth. The entrepreneurial skill that I teach best. Communication skills necessary to raise capital. The entrepreneurial lesson I teach. Communication, the key to raising capital. Communication, the key to raising capital, by Darren Weeks. Rich Dad said, Only lazy people use their own money to get rich. Entrepreneurs who want to be rich learn how to use OPM, other people's money, responsibly. Robert T. Kiyosaki. About a decade ago, I joined an exclusive membership organization that included various entrepreneurs from my hometown of Edmonton in Canada. In order to qualify for membership, you had to own a company that had annual sales in excess of $1.2 million. The group was formed so that successful leaders could help one another learn about business and personal development. We meet monthly and in small groups with 10 of our peers. In one of these meetings, a man who owned a very successful furniture store said something to me that I have never forgotten. He said, "Darren, of all our 80 members in Edmonton, you are truly the most entrepreneurial." I was shocked at this comment and listened as he continued to speak. He said he had never met someone who could start a business literally from scratch and with no family or financial help and grow it to one that had sales of over $1.2 million. Looking back, I now see that my entrepreneurial spirit has been strong since I was a young boy. I knew I always wanted to be rich, and my will has always been strong. When I first read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I immediately saw an opportunity to teach others financial literacy through the cash flow game. That realization was all it took for me to begin the path as a teacher. I found that you just need to believe you will be successful and start taking steps in the direction of making that thought a reality. From that day forward, I did something every day to further my belief in being a successful entrepreneur using the cash flow game as my tool to create a vibrant business. And 15 years later, I completed that chapter in my life when I sold my seminar business. I believe the strongest attribute that I bring to the Rich Dad family is my ability to identify entrepreneurs and guide them based on my experiences and their goals. Whether it's someone who has no money to start a venture, wants to buy their first rental property, lacks revenue growth, wants to hire an employee, or simply doesn't see their own potential, I believe I can help that person. Many people call this gift experience, and that's a huge piece of it. I can see, and have trained myself to see, things most people cannot see or simply aren't looking for when it comes to business. I've found that I can create things out of nothing. Most importantly, I can see the potential in people who need a helping hand with a word of encouragement or a gentle nudge of awareness that they need to focus or get back on track. Lots of people who know me and my background may be thinking that Darren is all about raising capital, and I have not yet mentioned that. I have raised a lot of money over my career. Over $500 million that was then invested in more than 5,000 apartment units, raw land, cruise ship terminals, and much more. Even I look at that number and am impressed with all of the zeros. But in my opinion, raising capital is not my primary strength. My true strength, I believe, is putting together all of the pieces that will make a business successful. The analogy I use often is that a business is like a large, complicated jigsaw puzzle. It takes skill to put the pieces together in the right sequence so a complete picture is created. Mastering the skills to build that masterpiece is what I like to do and believe I do very well. Raising capital is only one of those pieces. Can I show you how to raise capital? Absolutely. But prior to taking steps to raise capital, you need to have a strong mission, be able to lead people, have a strong brand, and know how to communicate so your business can grow. And of course, you need a track record of success that shows potential investors that you have the skills and experience that people want to invest in. How do I help people with developing these skills? Practice, practice, and more practice. I roll up my sleeves and practice with people. I show them the way. the way that I've been doing it for 30 years or more. Over the last few years, I've dedicated my time to helping entrepreneurs all over the world improve their entrepreneurial skills. I have seen amazing transformations of entrepreneurs who practice in a safe environment with other entrepreneurs. Then, when they are unleashed and enter the real world, that practice pays off as they achieve fantastic results and their businesses flourish. Are the results always positive? No, that's reality. And life in the real world. Many times when I'm working with an entrepreneur, something doesn't work as well as they had hoped. But when you can communicate with someone who has been down that road before, someone who understands that part of the process is correcting and adjusting as you go, it is magical when we debrief the experience and turn it into a positive, and they try it again. Practice, implement, learn, practice, and implement again. It's the circle of an entrepreneur's life. It has been an amazing journey as I look back to when I first read Rich Dad Poor Dad in 2001. I have met tens of thousands of positive people at seminars all over the world, and I have become a better person in the process as I realize that personal development is just as important as business training. I am forever grateful to become a Rich Dad Advisor and be among a group that holds both education and personal development in such high regards. In 2001, when I hosted my first cash flow game event, only 4 people showed up. Never in my wildest dreams did I believe that one day I would speak on the same stage as Robert Kiyosaki and become friends with him, Kim, and their advisors. Robert and Kim have been amazing mentors and incredible supporters over the years. My closing words: keep working on the skills you need to be a successful entrepreneur, and I am sure you will find that, in the process, you will become a better and stronger person. I know it has worked that way for me. About Darren Weeks. Darren Weeks has always had a passion for investing. In grade 6, he began investing in mutual funds. By junior high school, he moved on to penny stocks. In high school, Darren was investing in physical commodities, including silver bars. Using his investment profits, Darren bought his first rental property as a business student at the University of Alberta, and he still owns that property today. Finishing with a degree in accounting, Darren continued to add more rental properties as opportunities appeared. Once he graduated from university, he was sidetracked from investing. For several years, Darren did what everyone else was doing, working 9 to 5 to make ends meet and looking forward to the weekends. He worked in accounting and sales roles for a variety of organizations and kept investing in real estate on the side. Darren slowly added more doors to his real estate portfolio while feeling increasingly limited and stifled by the traditional career path. Everything changed in 2001. When a friend recommended that Darren read a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. The book so perfectly articulated all of his beliefs about money that it reignited the passion for investing he had had in his youth. Shortly after reading the book, he made the life-altering decision to start Fast Track to Cash Flow, a company that would teach Canadians the principles laid out in the book, in addition to the lessons Darren had learned about money over the years. Best of all, Fast Track seminars would be free of charge. This venture allowed him to give up the traditional career path and focus on his business and investing full-time. Fast forward to the present. Darren has amassed an investment portfolio consisting of over 4,000 rental properties across North America, tens of millions of dollars in energy interests, and hundreds of acres of land. He is also the largest individual shareholder in the world's largest cruise ship terminal, the Port of Falmouth, which is operated by Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines. Darren and his team are still providing events and conferences designed to expand the financial context of Canadians. Events about everything from budgeting, real estate, investing, entrepreneurship, raising capital, networking, marketing, personal development, and much more. More than 350,000 people have now attended the Fast Track Group events throughout the country. From a simple idea, the company has branched out to include several divisions. The success of the company has positioned the Fast Track Group among Canada's business elite, having been ranked on the Profit 200 list for 3 consecutive years. Darren was named a Rich Dad Advisor for raising capital in 2013. He sold the Fast Track Group in 2016 to focus once again on learning, teaching, mentoring, and investing. His passion to help others remains as strong as ever, as has his belief that financial literacy makes financial freedom possible for everyone. For books by Darren Weeks, please see companion file number 22. An excerpt from The Art of Raising Capital for Entrepreneurs and Investors by Darren Weeks. Chapter 1, Starting Out Right. Before you start reaching out to investors and partners to secure funding, there's some preparation that needs to be done. Trust me, the time you put into this preparation is going to pay off big time once you start approaching people for investment capital. A lot of the preparation is mental. The idea of using other people's money isn't a natural step for many entrepreneurs. My theory is that part of the reluctance is due to the business owner's fear of losing the business to unscrupulous partners with high-powered lawyers. We can all picture the scenario, and Hollywood helps us in this, where the hard-working entrepreneur loses control of everything in a legal loophole and sees his vision corrupted. I don't know where the entrepreneur's lawyer is on reviewing the contract in this scenario, but that's not the real irony of this common fear. The irony is that these same owners who fear partnering or selling private shares are the same people who have significant portions of their business and home pledged to the bank as collateral for loans. Banks aren't famous for their patience on late payments, and yes, they have no shortage of high-powered lawyers to take ownership of assets that are collateral against loans in arrears. I'd argue that partners willing to put money into your business will be much more understanding about the ups and downs, especially if you are communicating with them about their investment. More on that later. The other part of my theory on why entrepreneurs generally don't raise capital is that those who do, and are successful at it, often gloss over that part of their growth story. When people talk about Warren Buffett, long one of the world's richest men, they mainly talk about his career after acquiring the failing textile mill, Berkshire Hathaway. What gets glossed over is the fact that Buffett made his first millions by running investment partnerships he created with private capital from qualified investors. Funds from those partnerships were used to purchase Berkshire Hathaway, which he turned into a multi-billion dollar holding company for his acquired businesses. I am not trying to minimize Buffett's achievements. Anyone who has read his shareholder letters knows that Warren Buffett is one of the finest financial minds of all time. What I'm trying to draw attention to is the fact that, without raising capital, Warren Buffett's success wouldn't have happened as rapidly as it did. Buffett needed money from private investors in order to become the world's richest investor. Without that money, he'd still be the world's greatest investor, but not the richest. You can find the same theme of other people's money hidden in the background of most success stories. We like to read the fairy tale version where the young entrepreneur fights his or her way up the ladder without a helping hand from anyone. But it is just that, a fairy tale. I don't want to hit you over the head with example after example of well-known entrepreneurs who used other people's money to get where they are. There are enough to fill several books. I am simply trying to make the point that raising capital for your business isn't a sign of failure. It's a sign of success. When your business needs more money than you have on hand in order to grow, then you are doing something right. The power of capital. Before we get too deep into crafting your pitch, filtering prospects, and the other nuts and bolts of raising capital, it is worth looking at what capital can and cannot do. Capital in all its forms, dollar bills, silver coins, bars of gold, and so on, is time made tradable. When a business is well capitalized, it can survive the bumps and bruises of the market better than other businesses with less capital. For example, if your business has $10,000 in capital and your business takes $5,000 a month to operate, then you can survive 2 months of little or no profit. This is oversimplified, but the capital can buy you 2 months of time to make a profit. As any entrepreneur can tell you, time is the most valuable commodity there is when you are building a business. The power of capital to help buy time during tough times is important, but the ability of capital to compress time is even more exciting. When you have capital, you can scale up your business sooner, grow faster, and do more. Imagine how long it would take a business to grow if it could only use its profits to fund expansion. You could spend months of saving up enough profit for a new piece of equipment and years saving up enough to pay an employee or open a new office. There are many points in your business where an injection of capital is necessary. You may need new equipment, better software, a bigger oven, or any of a thousand other things that you don't have the money on hand to cover. Rather than raising capital in these situations, most entrepreneurs go to the bank or get short-term funding from friends and family. When these sources are tapped out, those businesses fold up and disappear. And this might not be a bad thing, because there are limitations on the power of capital. Is capital all you need? One thing capital cannot do is turn a failing business into a strong business. If your business is flawed and the profits are just not there, then all capital can do is allow you to continue operating longer than you could have without it. In these situations, capital gives you the time to waste more of your time and money. Whether or not you should be raising capital at all is an important question. It is also a sensitive one, because we all believe that our business idea is sound, or else we wouldn't be putting our own time and money into it. But you have to ask and honestly answer the following question. Is a lack of capital the only thing holding my business back? When I speak at conferences, this is the question I throw back at people who tell me they are struggling to get their fantastic business, more often a business idea, off the ground. When we actually talk it through, it usually turns out that a lack of capital is not the most pressing issue facing these well-intentioned people. Instead, they are struggling because they don't have a clear path to profitability, or are too focused on making a product rather than selling it, or don't have any partners, and on and on. Some people, however, do have a clear capital problem. In general, they have businesses that have a clear plan to become profitable and are run by a strong team. If a business is already turning a profit and can provide returns on invested capital, then it is all but screaming for more money to grow, whether or not the business owner can hear it. The investor's view. The ability to provide excess returns on invested capital sounds like it should be the most important point to your investors. After all, if I invest money in your pizza business to help you buy a new oven, I'm not doing it out of the goodness of my heart. If I want to feel good, I will give money to charity, not a business. My goal as an investor is to help you scale up your business because there is money in it for both of us. If a new oven helps you make more pizzas to sell and that increases your profits, I am expecting you to pay back my investment plus a healthy bonus. In the real world, however, the amount of return you can provide on invested capital is often the least important thing to your investors. The most important thing to investors, especially the ones that invest capital into private partnerships and joint ventures, is whether or not they can trust you to deliver on what you say. If you and I have no prior relationship, I don't care whether you promise me a 10% return or a 1,000% return. I am not giving you money because I don't know you from Adam, or Bernie Madoff for that matter. If, however, you show me how you've produced profits in the past and introduce me to your team, I am probably going to hear out your business proposal. That is, I will if you've put the effort into preparing and carrying yourself like a professional. Creating your professional persona. When I first started coaching entrepreneurs on raising capital, I was tempted to skip over the part about creating a professional persona. After all, most of the people attending were already professionals and business owners. When my first students arrived, many in sneakers and jeans, and over half without business cards, I realized that creating a professional persona was the most immediate lesson to be learned. Without it, you will be fighting an uphill battle for respect and trust. So before you go and make your first pitch, there are a few basic tools you need to have in place. Your appearance. One of the most powerful things you can give someone is presence, which is another way of saying confidence. We have done the on-stage transformation at some of my events where we focus on one small variable, the wardrobe a person wears, and improve it. It is a deceivingly simple thing to take someone wearing casual clothes and have them dressed in a high-quality suit and groomed by professionals, but it truly does make a huge difference in how they carry themselves. They take the stage with an entirely different gait. They stand with their shoulders back and their body open to the crowd. They smile more. Essentially, they send all those important signals that make us respect and trust them. They send these signals with their body language simply because they feel different in a suit. When I started raising capital from investors, I was still in my 20s and cursed with a baby face. I say cursed because I was trying to convince people that I had the experience needed to deliver on my business plan for a particular property. When potential investors saw me face to face, they probably doubted I had the experience to drive a car without an adult in the vehicle, let alone run an investment property. Right from the beginning, I knew I had a trust deficit to make up, because I looked even younger than I was. However, I made up that deficit, and it was suits that helped me do it. I was not a savvy shopper, nor an overly fashionable person, but I was able to find a men's clothing store with a manager who was both. I invested, yes, invested, in three suits and received the most exceptional fashion education you can in an hour. I left the store with my suits and tips on how to break up my new wardrobe with blazers and nice jeans to create three looks of professional, polished, and business casual. I wore those suits for all they were worth. I wore them to meetings with investors. I wore them to meetings with tenants. I wore them to meetings with the bank. And I wore them to trade shows. I became comfortable in a suit and tie, and people interpreted that comfort and my appearance as a sign of maturity. I am not saying you need to invest thousands in a wardrobe just to talk to investors, but it is important to understand that the clothes you wear and the time you put into your appearance are visual cues for everyone you meet. For better or worse, you are giving them information that they are interpreting either positively or negatively. People invested billions with Mark Zuckerberg, but they did it despite his trademark hooded sweater, because he had already distinguished himself as a programming and business phenom. His known talents trumped any opinions people may have had about his appearance, although his wardrobe was the focus of many media headlines. The chances are good that you are an unknown quantity for many of the investors you meet, so it is well worth your time and money to make sure that your appearance isn't digging you into a hole before you even get a chance to open your mouth. And, for what it's worth, I still wear a suit to most meetings even after over 2 decades and hundreds of millions raised, although I've finally gotten away from the tie, most of the time. Your business cards. In the age of LinkedIn, Facebook, company pages, Quora, and the 15 new social media services that will pop up as you are listening to this, I get a bit of grief on my insistence that people carry business cards. Now and for the foreseeable future, the business card is the global standard for sharing contact information and is a part of our business etiquette. I have seen too many people ruin a good conversation by pulling out a smartphone instead of a card. They spend the next few minutes seeing if they have a compatible app for sharing their information. Then they spend the rest of the conversation discussing the merits of their particular phone or scrolling through alerts while pretending to hear what the other person is saying. Whether you input all of the cards you receive into your smartphone later is your business. But in a networking situation, your smartphone kills conversations. Instead, spend the money to get physical business cards printed out. I find that the most effective cards are ones that clearly state the business you are in and give the most relevant contact information. For example, if you are raising capital to do real estate deals, then your card should say Real Estate Investor right below your name and give your email, website, and phone number. I have found that there is a lot of value in having your card professionally designed by people who understand complementary colors and can speak to difference in spacing between font families. But all that really matters is that you have functional business cards that you carry with you at all times. When it comes time to hand over your card, make sure that you receive a card for everyone you give. This is good business etiquette, but it serves a practical purpose as well. All too often, you'll have a promising conversation with someone and realize you didn't grab their card at the end, meaning you are left with a one-way connection and no possibility of following up. Another technique you can use to expand the impact of your card is to write a dollar figure on the back, like $500 or $1,000. When you hand the card to someone, hand it to them with the dollar figure showing. When they ask you about it, let them know that that is the referral fee you pay if they connect you with someone who ends up investing in a property with you. This ensures that they will keep your card and remember you while also increasing your chances of getting an out-of-network referral. Be sure to work with your attorney on this as jurisdictions vary. More business card tips. No logo is better than a confusing one or clip art. Keep it readable. Vary the font size, not the font. Use centered text sparingly and default to aligning left. Your website. Like your business card and your wardrobe, your website will always be a work in progress. A website is a must-have from the perspective of raising capital because we are all Googling to find out more. A web presence lends authority and credibility, provided it is done right. The core of any website is the content. At a minimum, your website needs an information about page that describes your business, a bio page that highlights your journey to what you are doing now, a contact form that the user can fill out to receive more information, photos or videos that provide a visual introduction of yourself. With a basic site like the one just outlined, it can also help to put your phone number in the header or footer of every page just to make certain people can get from your site to you. This type of site is not going to cost you a lot to have built, and with a bit of patience, you can throw it together yourself through Google Sites, WordPress, or any of the hundreds of other free website builders out there. If you are going to spend the money on having a website built, it is worth considering your brand. For example, the colors on the website should reinforce those on your business cards and any marketing materials. Your brand is also going to inform the type of content you'll be offering people as you build out the website from its basics. Giving people free content through your website is a win-win when it comes to establishing your credentials. People that you have networked with offline can go to your site and see the article you wrote about tips for increasing real estate cash flow or the most important metrics for evaluating investment properties. and see that you know what you are talking about. Adding content to your website will also help you rank on the search engines and turn that content into a marketing tool that brings in more potential investors than you could ever personally meet in a lifetime. A deeper content base for your website will also pay off in making monthly newsletters and mailouts much easier in the future. We'll talk more about the importance of growing and systemizing your communications infrastructure throughout the book. Basic website tips for the do-it-yourselfer. Pick one font and stick to it. Arial is a good default. Try to have a few content types, including videos, photos, podcasts, and written articles. Resize photos for quicker load times, or use a web service like Google's Picasa to do it for you. Maintain a professional tone when writing and recording. I hope checking spelling and grammar goes without saying by now. Don't hesitate to get help. The resources on YouTube alone are staggering. Your online presence. Despite my impassioned defense of business cards, it is becoming clear that they will be replaced in the future in all but physical networking events. People will take your business cards, but they're most likely to use it to put your name in a search engine. This is something most of us have done just for interest's sake, but is now something that you'll be doing regularly as part of your online reputation management. Your online presence will include your website, as well as all the other online platforms you utilize. The size of the online presence is, of course, directly related to how much content you are putting out there. Much like people were once expected to have business cards, we now expect to see at least a LinkedIn account, if not Facebook and Twitter as well. Depending upon how common your name is, you may not even see your own information popping up unless you add in your city or other identifiers. When you've been in business longer and been a contributor to different media pieces and the subject of others, your ability to influence your online presence actually gets harder because you are not the originator of most of it. When you're just starting out, it is important to have something rather than nothing. There are different schools of thought on how much work you should put into social media and the value that those primarily personal networks like Facebook can generate. But for the purposes of raising capital, it is at least worth having a LinkedIn profile and even a company page with a few professional photos of yourself and your team. As you focus more on raising capital as your primary business and begin to tell your story, sending that content out on more platforms is great for increasing reach. Some sharing of content that would interest the type of investors you want to work with will help you define your online presence as you build it, but I would caution against spending too much time on it. At the end of the day, people are checking your online reputation after meeting with you in person, so you actually have to be networking and meeting with investors before maintaining your online reputation becomes a necessity. Your context and your content. Your context is another one of those intangibles like your appearance. People will pick up on it without any conscious effort. Your context refers to the mental framework you use to understand the content you are exposed to. If you are going to be successful in business, you need to expand your context and increase the range of content you are comfortable with. When I started out as a landlord, I had a decent context. I knew I wanted renters to pay off my property so I could buy more. I also knew that real estate could be the foundation for significant wealth. I had a conceptual framework for what I wanted to do, but I didn't know much of the actual content. I didn't know how to calculate cash flow or how to write off repairs against rental income. I didn't know how to create a rental contract or screen tenants. I was missing the content that I needed to fill out my context. It took me months of reading and attending seminars to become comfortable with the systems and lingo used in real estate investing. By the time I ran out of my own capital and started raising money from investors, I could talk at length about appreciation, curb appeal, renovation tax breaks, and nearly every aspect of running a real estate business. As you can imagine, my knowledge put investors at ease. To build capital effectively, you need to master the content of your business and the world of finance. Most